Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Joshua Redman's got the world swaying to his saxophone these days. The New York Times called Redman one of the most visible jazz musicians today. He is a natural improviser, a strong band leader, and at age 36, an articulate spokesman for jazz. He's fusing jazz and funk, stepping over musical boundaries to chart his own path, while still paying homage to his idols John Coltrane, Ornette Coleman, Sonny Rollins. He grew up in San Francisco, the son of legendary saxophonist Dewey Redman and a Russian-Jewish dancer, graduated at the top of his high school class and summa cum laude from Harvard. He was accepted to Yale Law School, but then took some time off in Brooklyn, New York, where he grew serious about jazz. By the late 90s, Redman established himself as a sophisticated experimenter, breaking down the boundaries between jazz, funk, soul, hip-hop, and pop music. Tonight on Point, saxophonist Joshua Redman, changing the shape of jazz music today. And joining me now from Buffalo, New York, is saxophonist, composer, and band leader Joshua Redman. He is artistic director of SF Jazz Spring Season, presently on tour with The Elastic Band. His new CDs are Momentum and the SF Collective. Welcome, Joshua Redman.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you with us. So much to talk about, so much fabulous music to listen to. Let me start with this new CD, Momentum. What did you set out to do here?
Well, I guess with Momentum, I set out to do the same thing I set out to do with every CD I've done and the same thing I set out to do every time I play, which is just to try to play some good, honest, creative music. You know, there's no great ambition or agenda here beyond that, and there never really has been for me as a musician. I mean, whatever musical situation I'm in, whatever the context, I try to bring as much sincerity and passion and creativity as possible. This project obviously is different from a lot of the projects that I've done before, because this band is it's really the first band that I've led that is not just an acoustic jazz band. In fact, it uses a lot of electric instruments, keyboards, and different sorts of effects. Also, from a stylistic standpoint, we explore territory other than kind of straight-ahead swing-based jazz. We explore different sorts of grooves, whether they're rock or funk or soul or different sorts of world music. So it definitely is. It kind of covers a wider stylistic territory. But the agenda, if there is one, is the same, which is to just try to play creatively and express something.
Well, as you surely know, there are people who describe jazz as something of an elitist art form. Does that bother you? Are you trying to really speak to a broader audience?
Well, I don't really think of the audience I'm trying to speak to. And that's... I intend no disrespect towards the audience. I mean, I have the utmost respect for the audience. I mean, music is a communicative art, and the expression wouldn't be complete. The communication wouldn't be complete if we were just kind of metaphorically yelling to nobody. Shouting in the dark. There has to be an audience there to complete the expression. But I don't think about specifically like what audience I'm speaking to or whom I want to hear the music. I try to focus on playing music that excites me and that excites the band. And if we can get excited about the music, if we can be creative with it and expressive with it, then we've kind of done our job, and the audience, you know, will come to it or not come to it as they see fit. You know, I don't really think about trying to speak to a broader audience or to a wider audience with my music. You know, some music may, and some of my music may, and some of my music may not, but it's not really a focus of mine.
I was fascinated in reading about some of your influences. Led Zeppelin was right up there.
Well, sure, yeah. I mean, I grew up listening to all kinds of music, and I definitely went through a pretty heavy rock and roll phase, and Led Zeppelin was definitely at the top of the list of a lot of those rock bands. I mean, I listened to Led Zeppelin and the Beatles and the Who and the Stones. Led Zeppelin's a great band, you know. I mean, you know, they're definitely... A lot of the music that comes out of Led Zeppelin, they spawned a lot of kind of music that's not my favorite, but they were a great rock band, a really creative band, really innovative in the studio, you know, great musicians.
I want to give everybody a chance to listen to your version of the Led Zeppelin song, The Crunge. This comes from your new CD, Momentum. That was one of the bands that you listened to growing up, Joshua Redman. Who are you listening to today? Who do you really love?
Well, I mean, I still love Led Zeppelin. I don't listen to them on a daily basis like I might have. But, you know, I mean, most of the musicians that I listen to and the bands I listened to when I was younger, I still come back to as sources of inspiration today, whether it's Led Zeppelin or the Beatles or Stevie Wonder or James Brown or the Temptations, Earth, Wind, and Fire. You know, in jazz, as you mentioned before, Sonny Rollins, John Coltrane, Ornette Coleman, my father, Miles Davis, Thelonious Monk. I mean, the list goes on and on. You know, I make it a point. It's very important for me to listen to music that a lot of my peers are doing, a lot of other jazz musicians of my generation, and they continually inspire me. People like Brad Meldow and Brian Blade and Christian McBride and Roy Hargrove, Nicholas Payton. You know, there's so many great musicians out there. I listen to hip hop. I listen to electronic music, and I also spend a fair amount of time not listening to music. I mean, as much as I love music and as much as I need music for inspiration, I also think it's very important to have a life outside of music. You know, I mean, for me to be able to express something as a musician, I have to have experiences that go beyond just music. So sometimes I find when I'm on the road and when I'm playing a lot of music, I don't spend a lot of time listening to music. And in a certain way, that keeps me, refreshes me, and keeps me, you know, keeps me inspired to play.
Do you still see it evolving then as other musical forms are evolving and it's all kind of an inclusive big tent where all influences are welcome?
Yes. I mean, I think that jazz is kind of by nature an open-ended music and an outward-looking music and a music that's capable of absorbing and recognizing many, many different styles and other genres, and at the same time still preserving its core and its soul. And I think that jazz is in a very exciting phase right now. It may not be the kind of revolutionary phase that it had been in other stages of its development, you know, but I think that right now there are so many different musicians out there doing interesting and exciting things and finding ways of incorporating all of their influences and all of the things that interest them into, making original statements.
There's much more ahead. We're talking this hour with saxophonist Joshua Redman about the future and present of jazz music, and also about his role as one of the most important figures in jazz today. We're going into the break with something called Swunk. It is a fusion of jazz and funk from Redman's new CD, Momentum. I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour with saxophonist, composer, and bandleader Joshua Redman about the future and present of jazz. His new CDs are Momentum and the SF Collective. Here is St. Thomas, a jazz classic written by Joshua Redman's idol Sonny Rollins, performed by Redman at the Village Vanguard in 1995. And Joshua Redman, I wonder how many of our listeners, like me, have heard that song so many times and really didn't know what it was. And like you, it kind of knocked your socks off the first time you heard it.
Yeah, well, Sonny Rollins is perhaps my greatest influence of all time, definitely on the saxophone, but beyond that, as an improviser. I mean, Sonny kind of showed me the light. He showed me the way towards and through improvisation, especially with the song and with the album that he first recorded the song on, Saxophone Colossus. After I heard Sonny Rollins' Saxophone Colossus, it really changed the way I thought about improvisation. It made me realize the true power and potential of improvisation, that improvisation could be, at the one hand, completely spontaneous, completely off the cuff, in the moment, immediate, and yet at the same time it could be logical and structured and coherent and have an incredible narrative flow. Sonny Rollins, for me, is the consummate storyteller as an improviser, and I think through listening to his work, especially this song, it really changed the way I approached improvisation.
Well, speaking of storytellers, you certainly have a fascinating one. You were 10 when you first picked up a saxophone, and then it sounds as if you weren't really that serious about it for quite some time. You were pre-med at Harvard, then you got into Yale Law School, decided maybe not yet, and then became serious about music. Trace that path a little bit for us, if you will.
Yeah, well, I was decidedly not serious about music, and that was because I think I was serious, you know, perhaps too serious about some other things, namely academics. I mean, I was a nerd, man. I was a serious student, I enjoyed studies to a point, and I enjoyed school to a point, but I also was very focused on learning and academics as a way to kind of to advance myself. I mean, I grew up with very little, I never wanted to be wealthy or even well off, but I wanted to have a certain kind of just security in terms of my life and to be able to support a family one day. And I never thought that music would be able to give me that. And beyond that, I really never thought that I had the talent to be a quality professional musician. And I still doubt that sometimes, but obviously I've been able to do it. You know, for me, music was the great escape. You know, music was an escape from, you know, the rigor and the discipline that I kind of poured into academics. And so for me with music was about having fun and joy. It wasn't about working and being serious and studying and practicing. I mean, I abhorred practicing. I just started practicing like 5 years ago.
time, huh?
Yeah, about time. I mean, I don't mean to sound that, I don't mean to say that I was flippant about music. I mean, I loved music and was serious about music as a listener, but not as a player. And, you know, that attitude has not served me well in many ways. You know, I think I've had to play catch up in a lot of ways because I haven't done the work that I should have been doing when I started playing. But maybe in some small way it served me well because I've always, for me, music has always been about the joy of it, about the fun. I've never attached music to any sort of expectations, whether they be financial or career or anything. For me, it's always been about the joy of playing, and I think that there's a certain innocence that I've had, hopefully that I've been able to preserve because of that attitude that I've always had.
And clearly some remarkable natural gifts that we hear in your music. I want to let everyone listen to some of your take of George Gershwin's often recorded Summertime. This is from your 1998 CD, Timeless Tales for Changing Times.
Thank you.
Joshua Redman, that was 7 years ago, and a lot of us, when we look at something that we did 7 years ago, we cringe.
I cringe when I look at something I did 7 weeks ago, or seven minutes ago.
But, you know, listening to that, I mean, there is the joy and the innocence and the fun, you know, in that, as well as a lot of soul. I mean, are you able to listen to that and hear all of that still?
Yeah, I think that sometimes, you know... Sometimes when I have enough distance from something that I've done, then I can kind of listen to it without that kind of intense self-criticism that I have. And that's one thing that's always driven me, is just this intense self-criticism. You know, I've always been able to see my faults far more acutely and clearly than I've been able to acknowledge my strengths. And with music, it's the same. So it's very difficult for me to listen to what I've done, if it's recently. But sometimes, like after 5 years, or you know, after a long time, I forget a lot of the things that I was thinking and a lot of the things I might have been trying to accomplish in that musical moment, and I can kind of listen back to it with more objectivity, if that's possible, and also with more of a sense of acceptance. But, you know, I can hear a lot of faults in what I just heard. Don't play me anymore, please.
Well, I'm not sure if I can be held to that. But I do want to ask you about some of your other experiences. One, playing live with the Rolling Stones. And also you've sat in on some sessions with the Dave Matthews Band. What were those experiences like?
Yeah, just once with both of those bands. And very short. I mean, with the Stones, I played with them for 2.5 minutes. But it was... in front of the biggest audience I'd ever played for. It was at the TWA Dome in St. Louis, and it was in front of probably 60,000 people or something like that. And I played on a song of theirs called "Waiting on a Friend," which I think was from the album "Tattoo You." And Sonny Rollins was the saxophonist who originally played on that song. So it was kind of a double thrill for me to be able to play with the Stones, one of the greatest rock bands of all time, and one of my favorite rock bands, and then to get to play, in a sense, kind of fill in for Sonny Rollins, who's, you know, my greatest influence as a saxophonist. And it was an incredible experience.
Was it a little surreal, you know, to be standing there?
Yeah, it was. Sometimes it feels like it didn't even happen. I mean, it was amazing. I mean, just to be there with those guys, and they were so warm and inviting and unpretentious, and you know, they just like to play music, and they made me feel welcome. And I walked out there and, you know, blew for a minute and a half, and then walked back, and you know, that was it. My moment of Stones glory, I guess.
Well, I guess that's the common experience of musicians at a certain level, isn't it? You respect each other. You admire what each other has done.
Well, I've found that the best musicians and the most accomplished musicians are often the most accepting and the most humble. I mean, you know, I've had the great fortune of I've had the opportunity to play with some of the greatest jazz musicians. You know, some of my absolute idols, people like Elvin Jones and Herbie Hancock, McCoy Tyner, Pat Metheny, Charlie Hayden, Billy Higgins, Roy Haynes. I mean, the list goes on and on. And you know, I found to a man and to a woman that these great master musicians are so down to earth and so natural and not conceited and not you know, they're very accepting and humble, and they've always made me feel welcome. You know, whereas I felt like I shouldn't have been. You know, but you know, I think a lot of times the attitude that I've encountered as a musician has come not from the people who should have the attitude, but from the people who shouldn't. You know,
exactly.
Young musicians like myself. You know, I mean, I find that the masters are just they're relaxed and at peace with the music.
Yeah, the word generous springs to mind. I want to hear some more of your music now. We have a piece called "Belonging," "Lopsided Lullaby," and this comes from your 2000 CD, "Beyond." Was from 2000, so just 5 years ago. You know, your work has changed a fair amount over the years. You've also recorded many songs by pop artists, Bob Dylan, The Beatles, Prince, Sheryl Crow. What do you think you bring to their songs?
Oh, I don't know. I couldn't begin to... You know, I mean, hopefully, when I play other people's music, you know, I try to capture some of what I feel is the essential spirit of that music and honor the music in that way. You know, I try to preserve some of what I feel is the essential mood and feeling of the music. And then I try to find an original way to interpret those songs. But I can't say what I can bring to their music. I mean, their music is amazing. It doesn't need me to reinterpret it, you know. So I choose material just based on how it inspires me and how it inspires the bands that I'm playing with at that time. You know, that's how I choose my material. Whether it's songs that I've written or whether it's songs that other people have written, the goal is to find music that can help unlock the creativity and expressive potential of whatever band I'm working with, and hopefully when we play other people's music, we can play it with passion and sincerity, honor the original spirit, but find something of our own to say with it.
Well, and also as you cross over into that world of rock, does that bring you something new that you then build on, or that you add to your thought process or musical process as you continue?
I think definitely. I mean, I think through it's not really about crossing over to the world of rock or to the world of a music other than jazz. It's I don't feel that genre crossing itself is something that's necessary, you know, for me or for any other jazz musician. It's natural for me, but it's not necessary. It's not a necessary thing. It's not like I feel that, oh, well, I need to get some of this rock and roll in order to be, you know, a better musician. You know, it's about, I think playing other people's music gives me an opportunity to express things and explore things that I wouldn't be able to express and explore just playing my own music. And that's true whether I'm playing, you know, a song by a rock musician or a pop musician, a soul musician, or another jazz musician. It's you know, it's no different whether I'm playing a song by Sheryl Crow or whether I'm playing a song by Sonny Rollins. Those are great songs which allow me and which allow the band to explore areas that we wouldn't be able to otherwise explore.
Well, we're going to continue that exploration after we take a brief break. We're talking this hour with Joshua Redman about breaking down the boundaries between jazz and pop music and other forms. We'll go into this break with Free Speech Phase 2. It comes from Passage of Time, released in 2001. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour with Joshua Redman about his career and the changing shape of jazz music. Here's Rise and Fall, an original Redman composition recorded live by the SF Jazz Collective. Joshua Redman, you've been the artistic director for the San Francisco Jazz Festival for a few years now. What's that been like? How's it been to help shape a jazz organization?
Well, it's been an amazing experience and a wonderful opportunity for me. I'm the artistic director of the SF Jazz Spring Season. SF Jazz has been presenting concerts in the Bay Area for a long time, and they're one of the premier jazz presenters in the nation, and they've been putting on the San Francisco Jazz Festival for well over 20 years. They brought me on board 6 years ago to build a new spring performing series, a series in the spring, which we call the SF Jazz Spring Season. And we just finished our sixth year of that. So it's been an amazing experience. I mean, they're a great organization, and they definitely don't need me to shape them. But it's been a good fit because their attitude about jazz, an attitude that really respects the heritage and history and language of jazz, but at the same time takes a very open-ended and an eclectic approach to presenting jazz. That's a philosophy and an attitude that's very in keeping with my own as a jazz musician. So it's been a natural fit, and it's just been, I've had a lot of fun.
When you perform these days and look out on the crowd, what are the faces you see? Are they young? Are they old? Is it everybody?
There are many, many different faces, many different ages, many different ethnicities, many different income levels. You know, I mean, I obviously can't read a lot of those things in the faces themselves, but jazz has a pretty wide ranging and diverse audience. I mean, we'd like it to be more diverse. I mean, I think it would, you know, we'd like to see jazz, the music that we present, you know, be. We'd like to make it available to as many people who would be interested in it as possible. I mean, it's a struggle in jazz in promoting the music and in presenting the music. It is a struggle sometimes to get people in the seats and to get the word out about the music, because it isn't a mainstream music by any stretch of the imagination, and it isn't a popular music. You know, it is. In a certain sense, it operates around the margins of our culture. You know, a lot of people aren't aware of it, and if they are aware of it, they may have a perception that it's a music that wouldn't speak to them. And I think that jazz has the potential not to be a pop music. By no stretch of the imagination does it have the potential to be a popular music, but it has the potential to reach, I think, a wider audience than it does, and hopefully, through the right way of presenting the music, more people who might be interested in it can discover it and be exposed to it.
Hmm. Well, as you look at your path, we've already talked a little bit about the many zigs and zags along the way that got you to where you are. What do you see ahead for you, both musically and would it be more performing? Would it be more along the lines of the SF Jazz Collective? What do you see?
Well, I just want to continue to play music and to play music with great musicians. I know that sounds a little simplistic, but that's really what it's about for me. Yes, I mean, performing is the most important thing that I do. I mean, I wouldn't be a jazz musician if I couldn't play live. That's what excites me the most still. Now, I love recording and I love artistic directing and I love being involved in these other areas of creativity. But for me, you know, the heart and soul of jazz is still, and music is still, performance. There's nothing that can replicate that experience of being in the moment, improvising, connecting with the musicians that you're playing with and connecting with the audience. That's where it's at, and I want to continue to do it and hopefully find ways of doing it more intensely and better as the years go on.
I've been sitting here reflecting on the challenges of being an artistic director, because I would think it's a little like herding cats. You know, aren't jazz musicians by their very nature pretty iconoclastic, you know, so that trying to get them on the same page for anything is something of a challenge.
Well, there's not much directing that goes into artistic directing, honestly. I mean, you know, it's about kind of, you know, conceptualizing and thinking about, you know, finding interesting combinations, whether it's interesting combinations of musicians for a particular band, or whether it's, you know, finding interesting combinations of musicians of bands for a particular concert, or concerts for a particular year. But what I try to do, and what we try to do at SF Jazz, is to try present in such a way that always respects the musicians and their original voices, whether those be, whether their attitudes or philosophies be iconoclastic or whether they be more traditional. We don't want to impose our concept on the musicians. We want to find a way to have a presenting concept which serves the musicians and allows them to express themselves in as true a way as possible.
Do you think that overall we are heading toward more of a fusion of these musical genres?
I think that there is a tremendous amount of fusion, if you want to call it that, cross-fertilization, interplay between, and conversations between different genres. But there is also a kind of a very solid core to each of these musics that shouldn't be lost. There's a very solid core to jazz, you know, a mainstream jazz tradition, whatever you want to call it, you know, the roots of the music, you know, and the trunk from which, you know, all the branches come out. That is there and shouldn't be dismissed. You know, I think it's wonderful that jazz can have that dialogue with all these different sorts of musics, and it's wonderful that jazz musicians, many of them, do feel free to experiment with other forms and other styles. But I think it's dangerous to assert that jazz needs to somehow fuse with other musics in order to stay alive, or that creative jazz music has to, you know, be some sort of fusion, that is the only future of jazz. I think there are many futures of jazz, and they're all bright. For me, if I'm playing in the moment and I'm inspired, then tradition, innovation, all that stuff kind of falls by the wayside. And at the same time, it's all included. You know, that's what jazz is about. It's music of the moment. And when you're in the moment, you know, everything is happening.
And it sounds like the perfect moment for me to say thank you so much, Joshua Redman, for being with us.
Thank you, Gail. It's been a pleasure.
We're going to end this hour with Sweet Nasty from Joshua Redman's new CD, Momentum. I'm Gail Harris. In for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. But first, let's listen back to some of the sounds of the past week.
I see from up close what's happening in Iraq. And I know we are making steady and substantial progresses.
In terms of the overall strength of the insurgency, I'd say it's about the same as it was.
Well, the vice president has said it's in its last throes. That's the statement of the vice president. It doesn't sound to me from your testimony or any other testimony here this morning that it is in its last throes.
The decision in talking to the president is that he strongly supports John Bolton, as we know, and he asks that we continue to work, and we'll continue to work.
If the administration goes forward with a recess appointment, I think that's a mistake, and I'd urge them not to do that. There are many qualified people who could be the UN ambassador from the United States.
Sesame Street is balanced. Big Bird is there, but so isn't Oscar the Grouch to represent the Republican point of view.
I made reference to the Nazis, to the Soviets, and other repressive regimes. Mr. President, I've come to understand that was a very poor choice of words.
Prime Minister graciously invited me to Vietnam. I will be going in 2006.
The two countries' relationship should be enhanced, we should aim to build a friendly relationship, constructive partnership, comprehensive cooperation.
In count one, we the jury find the defendant, Edgar Ray Killen, as to count one, guilty of manslaughter. Count two, we the jury find the defendant, Edgar Ray Killen, as to count two, guilty of manslaughter. Count three, we the jury find the defendant, Edgar Ray Killen, as to count three, guilty of manslaughter.
Iraq's Prime Minister Ibrahim El-Jafari gives an optimistic assessment during a visit with President Bush. Pentagon leaders field tough questions on Iraq from the Senate Armed Services Committee. Senate Democrats again successfully block a vote on John Bolton's nomination to be UN ambassador. The House votes to restore $100 million in funding to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which had been slashed in committee. Senator Richard Durbin apologizes for comments in which he compared the alleged abuse of prisoners in Guantanamo Bay to methods used by the Nazis and other repressive regimes. Vietnam's Prime Minister Phan Van Ky becomes the highest-ranking Vietnamese official to visit the White House since the end of the Vietnam War. And Edgar Ray Killen is convicted of three counts of manslaughter in the 1964 Mississippi burning murders and sentenced to 60 years in prison. Jack Beatty, what do you make of the news of the last week?
Well, I think we've seen some the shape of things to come, or at least politics to come, on the two main issues before the Bush administration: Social Security and trying to hold the public into the Iraq war. As you know, polls now show 60% of the public either want some or all of U.S. troops removed soon. And the administration president's going to give a speech next week trying to rally people around that. That's one sort of the official side of it. And then on the other side of it, Karl Rove, I think, gave a preview of what's going to happen if any Democrat moves to connect with that 60% sentiment. In other words, if we get an anti-war Democrat, someone who's running for president, for example, when Rove basically was saying the Democrats and liberals were ready to give therapy to terrorists and to understand them and didn't want to make war on them. Of course, Democrats in Congress voted overwhelmingly for the Afghanistan war. But White House people said, oh, no, we didn't mean that. We meant people like Michael Moore and MoveOn.org. Well, of course, taking those people to stand for Democrats and liberals is like taking Pat Robertson to stand for Mr. Bush. It's what you might say, it's unfair. So I think we see the official side, we're going to rally the troops, and then on the other side, Karl Rove is saying, we're going to make that 60% radioactive for the Democrat who tries to go after it.
Do you think part of the problem here is that the White House keeps saying we're making progress, and yet with day after day after day after day of suicide bombings, it's pretty hard for the American people to see that?
Yes, and Senator Hagel, the Republican, spoke to this last weekend. He said they're out of touch with reality. He was referencing Vice President's comment about, they're in the insurgency is in its last throes. And that's not good. That happened, you know, with the Johnson administration in Vietnam. That's what the credibility gap was. The difference between the administration's representations about we have seen the light at the tunnel and all the rest, and what was happening on the ground and what people saw on their television.
It's interesting. The V word keeps resurfacing periodically. I haven't heard it for a while, but now it seems to be very much on people's minds, both with the matter of establishing a timetable and also with the matter of, you know, is this another quagmire?
Is this another quagmire? And, you know, I was reminded of all the talk now is, well, we can't go till we retrain the Iraqi forces. Well, you know, President Kennedy, as you well remember, in one of his last interviews to Chet Huntley of NBC, he said, Mr. Huntley, in the final analysis, it's their country, meaning the South Vietnamese. They have to fight for it. And stories are now coming out about how even the trained forces will not fight until they're assured of U.S. backing. You know, it's their country, and finally they have to fight for it. All over the world, people have resisted insurgencies and fought for their country without all this training. And I think, you know, we've got to focus on this. Is this just a way of keeping us in there indefinitely and putting off the day when these people are going to have to fight? And if they're not willing to fight, well, that's the problem for the Iraqis, not for us.
I want to reconnect to something that you raised at the beginning of our conversation. That was about the politics of Social Security. Where are we on that?
Well, I think the Republicans, they were in a box because the privatization was going nowhere, the president's plan. But I think they found a good rallying cry. We're going to hear a lot of it. It's called Give Back the Surplus. Now they want to take the current Social Security surplus, which is, I don't know, $80 billion a year, and turn that over into privatization accounts. And they're going to put that to the Democrats and saying, you want to spend the Social Security surplus on current spending. We want to give it back. I think it'll be a good cry for them. Trouble is, that would do nothing for solvency. In fact, it would create an $800 billion hole in the deficit over a decade.
Jack Beatty, thanks so much. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.